Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
Good evening. If you will, open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2 will be where we will begin tonight, though the sermon will be more topical in nature. We'll start off there. As you can see from our banners that we have on display, this month has been a focus upon strengthening and supporting and encouraging our families in Christ. And as always, anytime you preach about the family or any aspect of the family, there's often some great care that and caution that needs to be used, because we don't want to hurt or alienate anyone who doesn't enjoy a certain aspect of family that others do, or someone that carries grief related to a certain aspect of the family that we may be preaching on. And so certainly that's something we want to be aware of tonight. If anything, I want to encourage us tonight to continue to reach out to people who are not like us, to continue doing things like we're doing with Into the City and other ministries, that these things are outreaches that reach out to people that are not like us, and things that we need to keep doing. But preaching on the ideal family or the model family certainly carries this danger, because a lot of folks don't have what we might picture as the ideal family, or possibly the ideal family is not so ideal. So tonight I want us to focus more on the fact that God can use many different types of family structures. As I was reading and studying this week, I came across a humorous list, which was the top 10 most dysfunctional families in the Bible. And again, this was intended to be a little bit of biblical humor, but he had number one was Adam's family, where a wife tricks a husband and one son kills another and then runs away. Had number two, you got Noah. He saves his family from the flood, but then gets drunk and exposes himself and has one son who seems to enjoy mocking him and gossiping about his father's error. Number three, you got Abraham's family. Of course, there's a whole lot going on with that family. You got a family that's promised a child but haven't had a child yet. So wife gives husband her Egyptian maid. He has a child with her. She turns around and makes fun of wife who doesn't have a child yet. So wife gets mad and kicks Egyptian maid and her son out of the tent. You got a lot going on with that one. Lot's family, of course, when they're in Sodom, you've got that strange text where it seems like he offers his two daughters to a homosexual mob. You've got a wife who's turned to salt because she's longing to go back to living in that situation. His story ends with two daughters becoming impregnated by their father. Isaac's family, you got one son cheating a brother and lying to his father. You got one son wanting to kill the other. You got a son running off to find safety with his uncle's family. Uncle cheats him or tricks him into marrying his ugly daughter when he really wanted to marry the pretty daughter. So you got a lot going on with Isaac's family. Jacob's family, he's got 12 sons, but he favors the youngest. So you got the 11, they take the youngest, they put him in a pit, they're planning to kill him, but then they decide, well, instead of killing him, we'll sell him into slavery, and then they tell Dad that an animal killed him. King Saul, he's got a shepherd who's become a great warrior. He gives his daughter to this shepherd, then decides, no, I'm going to take her back and give her to somebody else. And now I hate the shepherd and I'm going to kill him. But then he's got his own son who loves his friend, the shepherd, and honors that friendship and protects him from his dad, the king. So you got a lot of friction going on in that family. We've got King David. He has a fling with his neighbor and tries to cover it up by having her husband killed. Later on in life, he has a grown son who tries to usurp his throne and take the kingdom away from him. You get to number nine, Solomon, the smartest guy in the world, had 700 wives and 300 concubines. That's all we got to say about him. You get to number 10, Joseph and Mary's family, such great parents. They go on a road trip to Jerusalem, spend a little bit of time there. They get halfway home before they realize their son's not even with them. So great parents there. But again, this is all biblical humor. Just for a bonus, you could throw in the Apostle Paul. By the time we get to the guy who wrote most of the New Testament, he just opts out of the whole thing, says, I'm not getting married. So you got a lot of dysfunction, but the point is, from that little bit of humor, is that God can use dysfunctional people for his purposes. He can use you and I. He can use our family structures. He can use diverse family structures for his purposes. But really, I even struggle with what to call these different types of families, because I don't want to in any way imply that they're abnormal or that there's something wrong with us. I will say, just as a warning up front, that as I talk about diverse family structures tonight, I'm not in any way talking about any type of family that's unscriptural. I'm not talking about any marriage or family or relationship that God has not approved of. I'm definitely not preaching about homosexual relationships. I'm talking about simply a family structure that might not meet the ideal picture that pops into our head when we think about the family. It's something that's close to my heart because I live in one of these families. It's close to my heart, and honestly, maybe we don't meet the ideal family structure that pops into our heads, but I don't think there's anything abnormal. I don't think there's anything wrong with us. I think we're more normal than a lot of the families that folks look at as the ideal family. So let's think tonight about families in Christ. Let's begin thinking about a biblical description of family. Think about just the word family that's on the screen in front of you. When you think about family, what image pops into your head? I did a quick Google search this week. Just typed in family, wanted to see what images came up. And pretty much every image that came up was the image that I think pops into most American minds, which is the nuclear family. Mom and dad is the first marriage for each of them, living with their biological children. That's typically the traditional type of family structure in our culture. It's viewed as the ideal family. So when we think about family, it's not abnormal for an American to have that pop into their heads. So I think maybe American culture is not the best place to begin when we define family. The Bible's always the best place to go when we want to define something. So let's go to the Bible. Let's go back to in the beginning and get to Genesis chapter 2. In the beginning, of course, God created man. So Genesis 1:27, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. In the image of God created he them. He created man first and placed him in the garden in order to care for and to nurture God's creation. But something seemed to have been missing. By the time we get to Genesis chapter 2, we find God saying it's not good that man should be alone. You see, what's happened is in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 20, you see, man wasn't an ignorant cave dweller. He was educated. He was intelligent. God brings the animals before man. He's going to name the animals. What he starts to recognize is there's a female counterpart for every male. But as Adam's naming these animals, he's realizing, but there's not a helper for me. There's something that's missing. So God puts Adam to sleep, and he forms the woman from a rib in his side. You see, Adam needed someone that he could share life with. You got to think, as he's seeing all these animals pass through, if he were simply looking for a servant, he might have seen some promise in some of them. You think about man's best friend, the dog. Think about the way we love horses. He might have seen some promise in some of those. But there was something missing. He needed someone to share life with, not someone to do life for him. And so God created Eve from the rib in his side. She was similar to him, but different in all the exact ways that she needed to be different. She was someone he could share life with. And God goes on, and we're given the definition in Genesis 2 and 24 of the definition of marriage, that man's supposed to leave the body from which he came from, that's his parents, and he's supposed to cleave to his wife, and they're together going to become one flesh. So you might think of the idea of you never really know someone until you walk a mile in their shoes. God seems to take that a step further here in saying that marriage is kind of like a three-legged race. It's like walking together in the same feet. It's kind of like sharing the same feet with somebody as we share in this thing that we call life. But that's a great place to begin our biblical description of marriage. If anything, there's the ideal marriage. And then maybe man messes it up from there. But I think we can add to this idea, we can add to this idea or to this description the idea of the Old Testament household. And when we do that, I think it's going to expand or extend our definition of the family. Of course, in the Old Testament, God often called Israel a household. But this idea of Israel as a household is quite different than the American household. The average American household has 2.6 people living in it. The average Hebrew household is estimated to have had between 50 and 100 people living in it. The only real limit to the size of a Hebrew household would have been the ability of the householder or the patriarch to provide for all of those who lived in the household. Households, they might have included many different families or individuals or widows or orphans, folks that all came together for a similar purpose. They worked together as an economic unit, striving for the same goals and same livelihood. I think we can look to the love story of Ruth and Boaz as a good example of an Old Testament household and the extent that it expanded to. Of course, you got the story of Naomi and her family. They leave the land of her inheritance and they move into Moab because there had been famine in the land. And they get there and her two sons marry, but not too long later, her husband passes away, her sons pass away. She and these two daughter-in-laws, they're left in this devastating situation. They're in a foreign country. They're away from the household. They're away from a clan. They've lost the men who could have provided for them in that culture. They're left in this devastating situation of not being able to provide for themselves. So what do? One daughter-in-law turns back, but you got Naomi and you got Ruth. They go back to the land of her inheritance. And you get to Ruth chapter 3, verses 8 and 9. You get this strange instruction from Naomi to Ruth, telling her to go to Boaz and to uncover, he's sleeping, uncover his feet and to lay there. And when he wakes up and asks her, "Who are you?" she says, "I'm Ruth, your servant." She asks him to spread his wings around her and to provide for her and to protect her, to care for her like a bird would do for its young. But the point there is that, well, there's a whole lot of good points in the story of Ruth, but of course you got a love story there. Boaz and Ruth are going to go on to marry. Jesus is going to come from that lineage. In the long term, you got the teaching of God's plan for the redemption of man is for all men, regardless of nation. But in the immediate context, you've got a request there to accept us as part of the household, to provide for us and to care for us. So maybe our description of the family expands a little bit when we add in that idea. But turn to the New Testament. I think Jesus' birth takes our description of the family even further. When you get to the New Testament, Matthew 1 and verse 1, you got the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ. You got 15 straight verses saying so-and-so begat so-and-so, and he begat so-and-so, and he begat so-and-so. And you start reading through that. By the time we get to verse 16, we're really, really expecting to read something along the lines of, "And Joseph begat Jesus." But that's not what we get. When we get to verse 16, we see, "And Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus." So, of course, that's not what we were expecting. Of course, Jesus is born of a virgin. He didn't have a biological human father, but yet he was grafted in to the family. He was adopted by Joseph. What's that mean for our description of the family? I think it challenges us as Americans, if in our heads, the image that popped into our head was the nuclear family, husband and wife, first marriage for each of them, biological children. That all of a sudden means, hey, we got to add adoption or grafting in to that description. Add into that description what Paul teaches about death and remarriage, what Jesus in Matthew 19 taught about divorce and remarriage, and who may and may not be grafted into the family as a result of that. Our description of the family probably enlarges a little bit beyond that nuclear family image that popped into our heads. But if Jesus' family is not defined by biological roots, that tells me that the church should be the last place that people who are not in a nuclear family should be shunned. We ought to be accepting of them as God as God is. I think it's important to spend just a little bit of time this evening thinking about this definition, this description of the family. It's important for the church to have a clear description of the family because it communicates to others what we believe to be right and normal. You know, if you think about it, if every time we have a series on preaching on the family, if all we talk about is the nuclear family or the marriage, the raising of children, then we leave out a whole lot of people. We send a message. If all we talk about is the husband-wife relationship of marriage, then we're telling folks that are single there's something wrong with you. It's abnormal. If all we talk about as well as raising of children, then we tell married couples that do not have children there's something abnormal there. You know, that's just not right. That's kind of like the peg game at Cracker Barrel when you leave four or more. If that's what you believe, you're just a plain old ignoramus, is what that game says. But that's kind of what believing some of those things is like. Now, it's important for us to define the family because it shapes the ministries through which we try to reach out to others. We want to reach out to people that are not like us. We want to reach out to everyone we possibly can. We want to reach out with the same support and the same opportunities to different types of families. I'll give you an easier example to understand. Let's say we got an older married couple that's caring for an elderly parent. And let's say we've got two sisters who never married, but they live together and they take care of an old family friend down the street. That's a household. That's a family. The same support should be provided to each of them from the church. So it's important for us to understand a biblical description of the family. Let's take a look at some of the diverse families in our culture. Of course, you got lots of diverse families in the Bible. I don't want to sound like so much like a textbook tonight, but I know a lot of this is informative. I hope it's encouraging to us to think outside of our world, to think outside of what we experience each day. But in the Bible, you've got nuclear families, you've got extended families, you've got adoption, you've got widow families, single families, you've got intercultural marriages, you've got interracial marriages, you've got believers married with non-believers, you've got incestuous families, polygamous families, separated families, you name it, it's in the Bible. We've got the Christian family there as well. But we've also got diversity of family structures in our American culture. And as the church, we ought to be reaching out to every single one of them. I just want to highlight some of the different family structures as we think about the family tonight. Think about single adults. I want to put this next slide up there as I talk about all of these. This is from the Barna Group. This is an article they put out on some trends. Any of the statistics I refer to tonight comes from the Barna Group or from the U.S. Census. But there's some interesting statistics here. Some that we know, the divorce rate in the United States still hovers around 50%. The divorce rate for second marriages is somewhere around 70%. We know one of the really interesting, according to this graph, is that marriage tends to be more common among Christians. However, the likelihood that Christians have experienced a divorce is the same as the likelihood that non-Christians have experienced a divorce. That tells me that we're not immune from that as well. That tells me we can't not be seeking to reach divorcees with the gospel. But really, looking at a graph like this and thinking about single adults, that's one of the stats that really jumps out at me the most. As you see the comparison from year 2000 to 2016, while the divorce rate has generally stayed the same, less and less people are getting married now. Or among younger single adults, more and more people are waiting a whole lot longer before they get married. In fact, this is the single adults count as a household. This is the fastest growing household in America right now. Fastest growing household in America. If you added to that group those who have been divorced and are now single, those who have been widowed and are now single, That would mean that group would come to 40% of Americans would fall into that category. We ought to be reaching out to those who are single, regardless of the circumstance. But folks are, especially among the younger generations, they're waiting longer to get married. If you go back to 1960, the average age for marriage for a woman was age 20, for a man, age 22. Now the average age that women are getting married is age 27, and for men it's age 29. Folks are waiting a whole lot longer. The economy is such that a single person can support themselves a whole lot easier than maybe a single person could have in former times. Even looking at statistics like this on single people, it's hard to interpret them because you've got a whole lot of folks living in threes company type situations, living with roommates. You've got a whole lot of folks cohabiting before marriage. That's a great struggle that the church has got to deal with. That's more accepted now than it ever has been before, and it all contributes to the reason why people are waiting longer to get married. But the fact is that the church can't afford, if you look at numbers like this, if that's the fastest growing household, the church can't afford to overlook single adults. You know, it's amazing, the model that most churches follow is that of reaching out to families. And we've got family ministries and we've got youth ministries, but there's often a huge gap in the 20s. And the 20s are so crucial. Those are the years where folks are really deciding who they are, what they believe, what they're going to stand for. And so often it's kind of like, well, we're going to minister to you here and we hope that you'll come back married over here. But somewhere in there, we don't know what's going on with you. That's sort of, generally speaking, about American churches. That's the model that's often followed. But the point is that we don't need to overlook the people in that in-between stage, in the single stage, because single adults need the gospel as well. You can think about childless families. This is a couple that either by choice or because they cannot, have not had children. You might call childless families the forgotten family in American culture because they're so often overlooked. And whether or not we realize it or not, they're so often overlooked in the church. You know, talk about we don't want to inadvertently hurt someone's feelings. So often childless families are the ones who get their feelings hurt because they sort of relate to these folks over here, and they sort of relate because they're married and they don't have any children at home anymore. And they sort of relate to these folks because they're married, but they've got children. They're going through stages that this couple's not. So we got to be careful to not exclude them, to not forget about them. You got single parent families in our culture. Of course, that's one parent raising one or more biological children. Maybe that's due to never marrying. Maybe it's due to death. Maybe it's due to divorce. But this family, this single parent family represents a major trend in our culture. Do you know that 1 in 4 children born in America is born to a single mother? 25%. If we're talking about we're interested in children's ministry, well, 25% of them were probably born into single parent families. We got grandparents' families. That's grandparents that are raising their grandchildren. That's due to things like, again, death, addiction, abandonment. Again, a stat that we might not recognize as often, 1 in 14 children in America are being raised by grandparents without the presence of parents in the child's life. We've got extended families. Of course, that's a growing trend where you got 2 or more family members, maybe they're related by blood or by marriage, but also living with other relatives, possibly multi-generational extended family, all living in the same household, all working together toward the same goals. As immigration increases, this type of family is increasing in the U.S. as well because it's much more, traditionally, it's been much more common outside of the U.S. But now it's something that is growing here as well as all over the world. We got the nuclear family in our culture, of course. That's the traditional, typical family, 2 parents, first marriage for them, their own biological children. It's long viewed as the ideal family structure. That's the ideal structure to raise children in. Traditionally, children that grow up in the nuclear family, here's why we preach it so much, children that grow up in the nuclear family generally have better opportunities for their own future. They generally have better opportunities to not get sidetracked by negative things but to build a successful future for themselves as well. We've got step families in our culture. That's two separate families that have merged into one new family unit. These families are incredibly common in our culture. Again, if the divorce rate is 50%, then we've got a lot of step families in our culture. The church can be a great support to families like this. Sometimes we call these families blended families. I'm not sure that I like the wording of a blended family. The idea comes from a blender. You put a whole bunch of things in a blender, it's going to blend it all up so that it's one smooth mixture. But when you think about the blended family, folks come into that family, they've got their own backgrounds, they've got their own habits, they've got their own values. Every single person in that blended family has that background. It's very difficult to attain that oneness. So I'm not sure that I like the blended family. Of course, the real danger there, some folks that are trying to build a blended family, it can be successful, but some folks try to microwave up a step family way too quickly. Often you can see that. Maybe they love that idea of oneness. Well, we're just one all of a sudden. You know what happens when I was younger? You know, you have certain meals. You can put it in the oven and wait 45 minutes to eat it, or you can throw it in the microwave and wait 3 minutes to eat it. And sometimes what happens is we want to throw it all in the microwave carelessly without paying a whole lot of attention. And you know what can happen if you do it that way? It can explode into a really big mess inside your microwave. Sometimes that's what folks do with their blended families. They're trying to microwave up that oneness a little too quickly. So certainly there's great opportunity for the church to minister to these families as well. Let's think now about how can Graymere minister to diverse families? Again, I know a lot of that sounds like a textbook, and I'm sorry, but it's something that's been on my mind and on my heart, and that it fits with what we're studying this month, and I wanted to share that with you. But ultimately, kind of like the Into the City, how can we reach out to people that are not like us? When we think about diverse families, how can we reach out to families that are not like us? Again, this is not an exhaustive list. It's not a list that came from a textbook. It's not a list that came from a sermon. I really struggled to even prepare this sermon because there's not a lot of sermons on this topic out there to listen to. But these are things, conclusions that I reached of how can Graymere continue to do a good job or even enhance what we're already doing in ministering to diverse family structures. We need to meet the needs of various family structures. Again, sometimes when we try to meet certain needs, we run the risk of overlooking others. And I think all churches are probably guilty of this at times. If we're going to focus on parenting, that's great. And if we're going to focus on marriage, that's great. But we got to notice that there's some other structures that need some attention as well. Think about all the different interests that we tailor things to. October's coming up. We're going to have a trunk or treat where that's an interest of families with children. We're going to do that because we want to meet that need. They're interested in that. We'd rather them be interested in that here together with the church family. That's a good thing. But again, thinking about the idea of the young adults, fastest growing household in the United States. There's that forgotten age in the 20s. We address some things when they're in the youth group, but then we get afraid to address some of those things among the adult congregation. Maybe it's okay to talk about career goals to the congregation. It's okay to talk about sex and abstinence to the congregation. It's okay to talk about the complexities of adult dating. That's an issue that most of us probably feel like we know very little about. One aspect of modern adult dating that I don't understand very well is online dating. But apparently that's really big with people in their 20s. So maybe we need to get to know a little bit more about that so that we can address those needs. So often we minister to them in the youth group. Again, now we're waiting. We're hoping someday they get married and come back in their 30s. But there in the middle, when we ought to be ministering to them in those formation years, we've left them and thinking, well, the church isn't really relevant to me anymore. But if we can not be afraid to address those things, if we can meet all the needs or the needs of various family structures, then that's a way that that we can help the church to grow. I think we can develop faith families. Graymere is so good at this. My mind and my eyes just immediately went to a family here that I often think of. When I think about a faith family, that is kind of like the idea of adopting a college student that's away from home. We've got some folks here that are so good about adopting others and bringing them in, sharing life with them. We all ought to be about that. Birds of a feather flock together, but we ought to start including some feathers that don't look like ours. And we've got some families here that do a great job in that area. But we ought to pull in the single adults. We ought to pull in the widows. We ought to pull in the blended families. We ought to pull in the divorcees. Rather than letting them slip through the cracks, we need to pull folks in and connect with them. We can't afford anymore to let anybody slip through the cracks because they don't feel like they have a connection here. This is a way that we can minister to diverse families. We need to equip diverse families to reach out to other diverse families as well. Sometimes, as I was studying this, I was thinking, it's not all about ministering to diverse families, because God can use all different types of families. We need to equip families to reach out to others. It's natural and it's easier for us to reach out to people that are like us, so let's equip our diverse families to reach out to other diverse families. Think about, again, single adults. Who better to reach out to single adults than somebody who understands what it's like to be a single adult? I imagine the Apostle Paul was really good at reaching out to single adults. However, he would have a really difficult time getting a ministry job in the U.S. because churches don't often like to have single preachers. But maybe we can use some of those family structures to reach out to other family structures that are like that. Who better to reach out and provide care and support and encouragement to divorcees than somebody who's been through that situation? We got a divorce rate of 50%. Christians also are not immune to that situation. So we ought to be reaching out. We ought to be using our experiences in order to reach out to others as well. We can provide ongoing support to families in the congregation. I mentioned I'm not all that big of a fan of the idea, the term of the blended family, certainly not of a microwave family. I do like the idea of the slow cooker family, because I think that's what it takes to build any kind of good family. It doesn't happen overnight, though slow cooker does sort of happen overnight. But generally speaking, the illustration is that it takes a little bit of time. With the slow cooker, you got to little by little add in the right things. You got to give it time in order for it to become the meal that you want it to be. I think that applies to blended families. I think that applies to all diverse family structures. So we need to continue over time to we need to preach on parenting. Yes, we need to preach on marriage. But we also need to provide care for those who have gone through a divorce. We also need to reach out to the forgotten families without children. We also need to reach out to the young adults in their 20s. We need to reach out to our widows. We do such a good job of that here at Graymere. We need to help all of our families to be in Christ. We need to help all of our families to grow in right doing in Christ. As we conclude tonight, let me go back to this idea of Jesus and his birth. God's family is much more than a biological unit. This family here at Graymere is so much more. Some of you are related, but it's so much more than a biological unit. In Matthew 12, verse 46 through 50, while Jesus was speaking, he's told that his mother and his brothers were wanting to speak to him. And he looked and he said, "Well, who is my mother? And who are my brothers?" And stretching out his hands toward his disciples, he said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother." Maybe there's somebody here tonight that feels like you've been slipping through the crack. Maybe you are in one of those diverse families I mentioned. But that shouldn't be a reason to slip through the cracks, because there's a family here that's not biological. All who do the will of the Father ought to find a place that they belong in this family here. If you'd like to belong to the family of Christ tonight, you can put him on in baptism by being buried with him and rising with him, free from sin, to walk and to obey him in right doing. If you'd like to respond to the Lord's invitation tonight, won't you come right now as we stand, as we sing?